I built a clothing company, and now I'm trying to build a pediatric sleep and wellness company. But I look at the impact that I'll have on my kids, on my wife, on my extended family, my friends, my team members, my investors. If I can have a positive impact through the things that I get to do in each of those circles, then that's a life that matters, because to the opening point, right, we are a speck of dust in an infinitesimally long timeline. I think when I was younger, I felt this sense of I have to do something truly great, right? Like, what if I live a life and not everyone knows my name? And as I've gotten older, I'm like, I really hope most people don't know my name, and that's okay. And I'm building consumer businesses, so I have to put myself out there in the world and spread the word of what I'm building. But that in and of itself, with the family life and everything along it, that's a life that matters to me.
Thanks for joining me for this week's episode of People Are the Answer. I truly believe that people are the only answer to the world's many problems. I'm Jeffrey M. Zucker, a serial entrepreneur, here to learn how innovators are creating outsized, transformational social impact and to shine a light on all the good happening in a world often hyper-focused on the negative. You know, I mentioned that serial entrepreneur aspect, and that leaves me doing a lot of different projects all the time, pretty much. And lately, I've been really focused on the launch of my new movie, The Late Game. It's about one night at a beer league hockey game. My business partner, Jeff Tyner, and I made it from a place of passion and also a place of frustration with Hollywood in wanting to create our own film and get it out there. It's been a multi-year process, at least 4 years on this, if you don't count the many years we discussed it prior. And I've had a little bit of, for better and worse, a little bit of tunnel vision in this launch period as we've started this year. And it's led me to take some time off from recording episodes of People Are the Answer, but you know, I'm now trying to get back into it and excited to dig back in. But working on the movie, it's been hard to really think about much else, and so I found myself not excited about recording, and so you know, I took a break, which I think is all right. And that said, I hope to be able to do that in the future, but also keep this show going. And I'm really excited to start us back with my good friend, Kevin Lavelle. He's an incredible entrepreneur who founded bustling clothing company Mizzen & Main, which happens to make pretty much the only button downs that I wear now since I met Kevin back in 2018. And not only because he's awesome, but also because the shirts are awesome, comfortable, stretchy. They are amazing. And he also has his newest venture, Harbor, where he's helping parents get better sleep and creating happier families. In between startups, Kevin spent time working with Stand Together, the incredible multifaceted foundation that we met through. Kevin and I discuss his lead up to becoming an entrepreneur, including living in Dubai, his ultimately getting the itch to do his own thing, endless searches for perfect fabrics, the difficulty of getting good sleep as a parent, and so much more. Here is Kevin Lavelle on People Are the Answer. Kevin, thanks so much for joining me on People Are the Answer.
I'm very glad to be a guest. I've loved listening to it, and of course, getting to know you over the last couple of years. This should be a fun, I think this will be our first recorded conversation, but glad to dive deep with you.
Yeah, likewise. Certainly a fan since we met, I think it was 2018. And, you know, I think I mentioned to you, this is my first recording I've done for the show in a while. I've been focused on my movie, The Late Game, and excited to get back into it. It's nice to do so with someone that I know, makes things a little more casual. And I also mentioned to you that just over this sort of hiatus time, I've been able to think about the podcast and, you know, trying to make it less rigid, a little less formal. So, you know, trying to go a little less scripted. So we'll see how it goes. Appreciate you kind of guinea pigging that with me.
Looking forward to it, man. Thank you.
Well, you know, one thing that in a show that I love, Rich Roll, you know, he starts off multiple episodes sometimes just saying, how are you? And, you know, initially that seems like, oh, isn't that just kind of a throwaway? But he said, well, that can change the whole dynamic of the entire conversation if people are honest. So how are you?
Thank you. Yeah. And honesty is certainly important, including just not always presenting the Instagram, everything is beautiful, everything is wonderful approach. I would say overall, and I don't mean this superfluously, but overall, life is great. And, you know, studying history and some really great thinkers, puts life into perspective because I'm breathing, I'm above ground, my family is presently healthy, and I get to work on things that I love. And so I gotta, start off and not give a glossy version of that, but say I'm great because of all of those things. I am one of the most fortunate people ever. And there's a great book I love. Oliver Berkman wrote 4,000 Weeks, and he basically says, like, yes, that, but also that you are alive in present day in the span of all of time. And when you think about the incredibly long odds that you exist at all, we should always remember that. Now, on the let's keep it real side, and also talk about some of the challenges. Launching startup number two over the course of the last, I've been working on it for almost 2 years. It's hard. Startups are incredibly difficult, and trying to launch something new is never easy to begin with. And it's just such an insane time right now. Raising money was brutal for it, and what I'm building, you got to raise a lot of money to build what I'm building. And trying to capture consumers' attention among the 42,000 things bombarding us every minute of every day. And ultimately, I have to acknowledge that, again, that is really hard, but I get to work on things that I love. And ultimately, I would generally sum it up. I can't remember. It was a not ritual, but somebody that I listened to recently that basically said, if you want to do anything worth doing and it's not hard, then it actually probably wasn't worth doing. So I remind myself of that in the moments of overwhelming stress and anxiety of trying to build a startup.
Yeah, I can certainly relate on the difficulty of startups and the difficulty of raising money of late. It's been really trying, but I'll briefly go back to what you said about just sort of having perspective about how lucky you are, how fortunate you are. Certainly those books behind you helped with that. And it's really important for people to sit back and have that perspective. Certainly not everyone does. And I think the fact that you can acknowledge both things are difficult, but you're very fortunate, are really important things to acknowledge that they can coexist.
Yeah, of course. And they coexist, and everyone's life kind of ebbs and flows. Some people unfortunately have far greater number of issues, health issues that can be persistent, family issues that can be taxing beyond, all explanation. But when those harder moments happen, savoring the good moments are all the more important. Ryan Holiday, I've been a huge fan of his work for a long time. There's a couple of his posts that really, really stuck with me over all the, I don't know how many hundreds or thousands of things I've read from him, and all the other stuff you see on the internet. He talks a lot about garbage time, and I have really, especially my kids are 5 and 7 now, tried to not make garbage time more perfect, but more so embrace what those moments are. And we've jumped straight into the philosophical, but I saw, I don't know whether it was Sahil Bloom or somebody like him, posted a, when you're on your deathbed, hopefully when you're really old, if you were to say, I would like to go back and relive one moment in time, sure, Disney World is a really special experience, and sure, going on a beach trip, all of those things, but actually it's probably that, like, all of us in bed at 7 a.m. on a Saturday morning. Maybe it was a little bit earlier than I wanted to wake up on a Saturday. But everybody laughing and hugging and just existing together, those are the things that actually are the most meaningful and impactful moments in my life, even if sometimes I allow myself to forget that. I couldn't agree more. And I'll say, because sometimes all of those pieces of advice and books and blogs and posts can be overwhelming to where it's like, oh my God, I'm not enjoying every moment, and everything should be the most important. There was a time in my life where I think I got a little overwhelmed by all of it, and now I kind of dabble and it ebbs and flows for me. It's more just like a, oh yeah, helpful reminder. Not that you need to be soaking up every minute of garbage time, but when garbage time is happening, to remember this concept, to remember the concept that these are the special moments. And I just hopped right into it, but I don't think I defined if anyone hadn't heard it before, but Ryan talks about, you know, garbage time is this idea of the space between. So when you're driving your kid to soccer practice, it's not a perfect moment that you would frame up and certainly not one you'd post on social media, but it's the, that time where it's just you and him or just you and her, or maybe all of you, that isn't scheduled perfect, or, you know, something that you think you would remember, but some of the most magical conversations and moments and memories can end up coming from that time that, that isn't something that you would necessarily, you know, put in a frame.
And you've talked about, you know, getting to work on things that you love, which is so important. What would you say generally motivates you in life?
Let's put a pin in that because I'm going to hit pause and flip it back for a second and say, how are you?
Fair. No, good question. You know, I'm pretty good overall. Again, I am blessed with a lot and fortunate. I'd say that, you know, working on launching this kind of grassroots low budget movie has been something that's had me burning the candle at both ends. And, you know, whether if I'm not working on the movie, I've generally been parenting. So right now is a good little break from that. But similar to you, I love it. Like, I really believe in what we're working on. I believe in the joy that it's bringing to people in the hockey community, and hearing relatability from other people that play has been really rewarding. So generally, I've been stressed and anxious trying to fill theaters at watch parties and trying to make sure people can find our movie and stuff like that. But very fortunate and doing well. My kids are growing, and, you know, my older one, Keelan, who's going to be 4 in June, he just, you know, is smarter every day and has new hobbies every day. Right now, he's really into coloring. So it's been fun to watch.
It's really so cool to see the phases that come on the kid front. And, you know, the number of surprises that have come for me in each phase of the kids' lives has been really special to observe. And Jen and I have talked many times about many years ago, I think Jack was maybe a year old or so. We were very lucky to go on a ski trip, and we saw a mom with her son. And I think he was probably maybe 7, 8, 9, which is right around Jack's age. And they were just having hot chocolate and talking it up and having a great time. And we had a, you know, 1-year-old at the time who was not with us, but we looked over and I think maybe the kid ran to the bathroom or something, and sort of, she just said to us, each phase gets more special, and it's not anything that's missing from the first phase, but you have all of that. And then you get all of these new pieces that build, and, you know, being able to have real conversations with this sentient being that has been living in your house is really cool. So maybe with that, your question, you know, what motivates me? I think that answer has continued to morph, but ultimately, especially now with a 7 and 5-year-old, I've much more so internalized than any point in my life prior. You know, once kids are born, things change, but each year that has gone by, raising kids that are resilient, grateful, and make the world a better place in some way, shape, or form is without a doubt the most important thing that I will end up doing. And the second piece of that is ultimately building a life that matters and of meaning. And I don't mean that I'm curing cancer or, you know, taking us to Mars. I built a clothing company, and now I'm trying to build a pediatric sleep and wellness company. But I look at the impact that I'll have on my kids, on my wife, on my extended family, my friends, my team members, my investors. If I can have a positive impact through the things that I get to do in each of those circles, then that's a life that matters, because to the opening point, right, we are a speck of dust in an infinitesimally long timeline. I think when I was younger, I felt this sense of, I have to do something truly great, right? Like, what if I live a life and not everyone knows my name? And as I've gotten older, I'm like, I really hope most people don't know my name, and that's okay. Right, I'm building consumer businesses, so I have to put myself out there in the world and spread the word of what I'm building. But that in and of itself, with the family life and everything along it, that's a life that matters to me.
Yeah. I definitely can relate to that. And it's interesting when the kids are really young, you know, they don't care about any of the outside noise. It's like, they don't care if you were on the front page of the Wall Street Journal yesterday. It's just like, Daddy, are you home playing with me? And, you know, our society slowly sort of ingratiates them to that, you know, to the point where I feel similarly. Like, I think as growing up, I was imagining, like, how can you be this big business person that everyone talks about and looks up to? And it's like, in reality, you need to fulfill your own needs and your family's needs. And it's so important to recognize that. So I think it's, there's a lot of people that don't have that perspective.
I have to acknowledge there are a lot of people who, based on their life circumstances, can't dedicate the amount of time that they might like to in terms of raising their kids. But I'm consistently surprised by how many people I see say that their children are the most important things in their lives. And then most of their decisions demonstrate the opposite. I don't know who it was, but they said, tell me your priorities, but show me your calendar. And I by no means claim to have this all sorted out. And oftentimes I get distracted by work and my phone is a constant ADHD battle for me to not be sucked in and pulled in. But ultimately the reality is your kids are the most important thing in your lifespan. Some people, I think few people who have kids would say they feel differently, but I think a lot of people actually do. And I don't say that from a moral superiority perspective. I'm not saying I'm better than, or if you feel differently, you're not as good. I believe that it's the most important thing that we will do in our lives. And a lot of people say that, but don't necessarily operate against it. And so I have to acknowledge, like, there's a constant battle of all the things that I feel like I should be doing or could be doing, and then sort of coming back to what's actually most important. And I've got a great group of friends and an incredible spouse that helps me keep coming back to that. I will also add, though, and it's a really cool feeling building a consumer business that's out there in the world. Mizzen and Main sponsors events around Dallas. And when we drive by a sign that has Mizzen and Main on it, Jack will say, Dada, that's Mizzen and Main. And he gets really excited. And now that I'm building a second business, and I don't have one of my cameras with me, but I can show, I've got one of my monitors here. Both my kids love coming into my office where I've got some of the prototypes, and they talk all about the cameras and the monitors. And having them see me do this matters a lot as well, because I work from home. But having them see that I work and it has meaning and it's what provides a life for us is a really cool experience.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I know our kids model themselves after us. You know, they won't necessarily do what we tell them, but they'll do what they see us doing. And so it's good they get to see you putting that effort in and to things that you care about.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So I want to step backwards a little bit. And, you know, you mentioned you're currently based in Dallas. You know, where did you grow up and what was it like there?
So I've been in Dallas for a long time. It's a great place to call home. I was born in the Northeast and then moved to Florida when I was 10. My dad's job had us move a little bit. And at the time when you move, it's, you know, so devastating and so terrible. And ultimately, turns out kids need resilience and kids need to overcome challenges and struggle to be able to do so later in their life. So very grateful for having moved a few times because it helped me, I think, just be much more comfortable, you know, meeting people and life changes. And when I moved to Florida, I went to a small private school right out of the gate. That's the school that we kind of started at. And then I don't remember exactly what it was, but I wanted something different. You know, going to a small private school, you're around all the same kids all the time. And there's some pretty ugly dynamics there that I remember. And so I ended up transferring to a public school. And I think in my eighth grade class, total class, maybe there were 50 kids total. And then when I went to the public high school, I think there were like 2,500 kids, maybe even 3,000. Our incoming freshman class, I think I remember we set the record for the school. It was like 1,200 kids. And it was so good for me to expand my horizons in that sense, because I just saw so much more of the world than I had scene. Now it's Sarasota, Florida, so we're not talking about like global perspective, but that changed my kind of just overall lens of the world. I went there for a couple, well, for high school, and ultimately got a scholarship to come to SMU, which is what brought me to Dallas. And my sister also got a scholarship to SMU, which is what put it on my radar. And then amongst all the choices in front of me, having a full scholarship to college ultimately was something that I just said I would be foolish not to go down this road. And Dallas also for me was really attractive because while there are some incredible schools to consider, going to Dallas, my network of people that I met while at school through the board and through mentorships and through, you know, random people that came to campus, it really opened up a lot of doors for me still to this day that have made a profound impact on my ability to start two companies. And so those were the driving decisions to come to Dallas. And then frankly, just as I look back in my life, moving a couple times, changing schools, so many of my friends were going to great schools in Florida, Florida State, Florida, Miami, et cetera. And I just wanted to do something different. And I also felt like even though I enjoyed going to a very big high school, you know, going to a state school with 50,000 people on campus and the broader ecosystem, just to me, was like, that's a little too much for me. I'd rather have a little bit smaller of an environment.
Got it. Yeah. No, I mean, it's quite the path and awesome to hear how you ended up at SMU. And I'm, you know, a lot of what I'm asking here is just, I like to determine how people sort of got where they are. And I'm curious if you experienced giving back as a kid, is that something that was modeled for you that you then brought into your life? Cause you and Jen give back to the community very tremendously. And I'm curious, you know, is that something that you sort of learned about as you went, or was it something you grew up with?
I think both. You know, I think some people, they are raised in almost an overwrought sense of even guilt where, okay, we don't deserve what we have. We should give back. And I look at the way that I was raised in there's always an opportunity to treat people well and do the right thing. And that can be small in terms of small acts of kindness up through giving to organizations that you feel like make a difference in your community. My parents have had some organizations that they have been, you know, excited to support and participate in over many years. And so seeing it's not about writing a check, because for some people they could write enormous checks and it actually has no impact or change on their lives or their children or any of those things, but they, you know, they get a lot of credit, down through people who don't have any money that they can give to philanthropy, but they make the world and those around them far better off because of the impact that they have. And I feel very grateful that I got to see, yes, some level of financial contribution that still pales in comparison to a lot of the philanthropic giving, but also then coming back through just treating people exceptionally well where you can, always certainly with kindness, but then finding ways to support folks. My parents have volunteered with organizations from a mentorship perspective as well. And so I got just a great dose of all of the above.
Yeah, that sounds like a good combination. And you know, you mentioned your time at SMU and how you were able to build a network in Dallas there. And, you know, from what I saw on, you know, LinkedIn, you spent about 4 years working between school and when you started Mizzen in Maine. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah.
And what, you know, what were you up to during that time? And, you know, what learnings did you bring with you into starting your first company?
So I was class of 2008 in college, which was, you know, the beginning of the end in some senses for the global economic picture. I was very fortunate to have a friend that worked at a company called Oliver Wyman. It used to be Mercer Management Consulting. They merged with Oliver Wyman Financial Services and created a smaller competitor to the McKinsey Bain BCG kind of strategy consulting groups. And I, coming out of school, didn't have a set path that I felt particularly driven towards, right? The people who are industrial engineers have a very defined path. People who study accounting have a very defined path. And I just didn't feel any specific pull, and consulting felt like a great option given some friends that I had that worked at these companies. And hey, what a great way to go learn from really brilliant people about a lot of different industries. So I got a job with Oliver Wyman, and that was in fall of 2007. I was right around the time, maybe it was just after Lehman Brothers officially collapsed. And within a few weeks of that happening, we got an email. I think there were maybe 100 of us that were hired across the country in all their different offices. And they basically said, if any of you would prefer to go back to grad school or do a fellowship or, you know, deferment or whatever, we'll hold your job for you if you want to wait a year. Looking back now, I'm like, there's no guarantee they would have held that job. But I wasn't really interested in grad school for a whole host of reasons. But they also put in that email, if some of you are interested in going to Dubai instead, let us know. And I thought, wow, okay, that's pretty interesting. I'd spent a year studying abroad in college, and I was really interested in continuing to kind of spread my wings. And so I have this odd balance of, you know, go for it, accept the change. And also I have a lot of questions and I want to be very detail oriented. And so I spent a day thinking about all the questions that I had for them about what does it mean to go to Dubai? I had a lot of questions. And so I emailed them the next day and said, yes, count me in, but I'd like to go through these questions. And they were like, oh, sorry, we only had 10 slots. And they were taken within 42 seconds of us sending this email. And I thought to myself, of course they were taken, right? You have all these people who are graduating college to go be a management consultant, and their offer is to go to Dubai. I screwed up by not just jumping on the offer. And something that my parents taught me more than I think maybe anything else was basically don't accept no if you want something to be true. Don't just accept no as an answer. And so I basically said, can we please get on the phone and talk about it? Or maybe I sent them an email. I basically presented my case and said, I just lived abroad for a year. The whole reason I applied to Oliver Wyman was to get staffed abroad and. And if you say yes, I will sign on the dotted line immediately. I don't care about any of the details. And they responded the next day and said, yeah, sure, no problem. And, you know, there's a lot of lessons to unpack in that. You can take from it what you will, but that meant I graduated in May, and my I spent some time in Dallas over the summer, and then I moved to Dubai in August of 2008. It was a very interesting experience on so many levels. We had 130 people-ish from 33 different countries in our one office. It was such a fascinating time on so many levels. You know, the global economy is collapsing on one side. In the Middle East, things just really couldn't have been growing any more than they were. I had a lot of great colleagues from, frankly, all over the world. And though I'd studied abroad, the Middle East was a far departure from Europe and Australia and even Asia, frankly. And so going over there, I read a lot of books. I tried to make sure that I could understand everything. I got a Rosetta Stone and tried to learn Arabic. Day one, I got there, I realized I do not need to learn Arabic in any way, shape, or form. Basically, all the Emiratis have no interest in placating my desire to learn Arabic. They speak perfect English, and they're not talking to me in Arabic. But in that, I got to learn so much in such a short period of time, working with brilliant partners and leaders, but then also I worked in Dubai, worked in Abu Dhabi, worked in Qatar, and worked in Saudi Arabia for that year. And basically every month for a year, my friends who I met, all my friends working over there, we just went somewhere new every month for a year. We had a 4-day weekend. So we went to Beirut and I went to Turkey. I went to Oman. We did a road trip into Oman. Some of us went to India. It was such a cool launching pad. And being 22 years old, I had an apartment overlooking the Palm Jumeirah. It was just such a crazy time. And then the global collapse that hit the US and the European areas in 2008 hit us basically on January 2nd, 2009. We all expected that we were going to be just fine, insulated from all the chaos in the rest of the world, and we were not. We went from something like a 95% utilization in our office of staff employed on active projects to like 12% because everyone just canceled their projects. So long story short there, I spent a year. It was great. I survived a round of layoffs and then decided, who knows how long this is going to last and if I'm going to get laid off, because it's a very real probability as a new hire in the Middle East for a consulting firm. I'll go back to the US and I'll start building my network there. So I came back to the US and spent another year working for the management consulting firm, just doing other work around the US.
Sounds like a remarkable experience. I mean, at that age, it's so important to gain knowledge of all these different cultures and, you know, sort of incorporate it into your worldview. And so, you know, you left kind of a kid and maybe you came back an adult.
Much more so. You know, studying abroad for a year is one thing, and it certainly opened my eyes. I got to go to a lot of different countries and learn a lot and study in other countries. But then as a working professional, you know, having to set up your apartment and having to set up your, I rented a car while I was there and, you know, trying to figure out all this stuff on your own, and not just under the cover of, you know, study abroad where you can call the university and they can help you, like you're on your own. That was a certainly a way to fast track growing up. And then, you know, coming back to the US for a year, I got to do consulting around the US and ultimately I could tell my heart wasn't in consulting long-term. Part of it is as a consultant, you basically are not a part of anything for any meaningful period of time. You are the smartest person in the room, even though I definitely was not. You have to pretend like you are. And then you hand off the project and you go to the next one. And then you go to the next one. There are lots of reasons consultants get a lot of grief, and they should. And also there are lots of times where they can come in and make a real impact on a company that they couldn't have made on their own. But I just knew that wasn't my career. So I reached out to a mentor of mine, Hunter Hunt, who is the CEO, one of the CEOs of Hunt Consolidated. He and his brother-in-law both run the company. And basically said, I'm tired of consulting and I'm very interested in you've built a great company and potentially being a part of what you're building. And long story short, I ended up going to work for Hunt Consolidated here in Dallas for a couple of years. And while I was there, I learned so much about how a great company can be built. They have a great culture. They celebrate in an annual meeting, despite being a private company, they have an annual meeting. They celebrate work anniversaries starting at either 15 or 20 years on stage. And then they only celebrate every 5 years. So it's like 15, 20, 25, 30 year anniversaries. They call people up on stage. That's the tenure that they have built there because of what a great company they built. But after working there for a few years, I just felt this pull on this entrepreneurial vision to say, I'm in my mid 20s. This would be a great place to build a career. And I know I would have a wonderful, happy life and get to do meaningful work. But I think I've got to do my own thing. And that's ultimately when I started Mizzen & Main.
Got it. Yeah. I mean, I can imagine that pull, you know, that most entrepreneurs get when they're in a situation that might be safe in some ways, but, you know, you really have that desire to create your own thing. And, you know, Mizzen & Main, incredible clothing company, you know, I'd seen ads and the stuff, but the first time that I really like was like, oh, Mizzen & Main was, I heard you speak, you were being interviewed at a Stand Together event. I think it was 2018, maybe Colorado Springs. And yeah, I bought some shirts while you were on stage. I was like, all right, I got to try these shirts out.
Thank you.
And yeah, absolutely. And now they are, you know, pretty much the only button downs that I wear, you know, super comfortable, stretchy, they don't wrinkle. You know, I can be a sales guy for Mizzen & Main.
You are a great salesperson. And I will say, certainly plenty of my friends have our product, but I have this warm, fuzzy feeling for you, Jeff, for so many reasons, but also I basically have not seen you in anything but a Mizzen & Main shirt. And that is a level of product love that I just can't thank you enough for. It's so awesome to see.
Absolutely. I appreciate it. I mean, when I love something, I tend to go all in one way or another. And yeah, I mean, for me, there's not a lot of comfortable clothes out there. I'm a bigger guy. I kind of fluctuate sizes sometimes. So the stretch is helpful. And yeah, I just kind of went all out. And I do remember like one event we were both at, I think I didn't have one on. I was like, oh, damn, I hope he doesn't notice. So maybe he didn't.
I did not. If I did, I, especially given your propensity to wear it all the time, I would have noticed. So I must have not seen you.
Well, yeah, no, I appreciate it. Thank you for creating these wonderful shirts initially. And so, you know, what led you to get into the clothing industry?
Certainly no historical fashion sense or experience in textiles, branding, design, or manufacturing. The backstory here is I, in college, worked a political internship in DC, which taught me I never wanted to work in politics. Thankfully, I had that experience very young, and I never went down that road. But I watched a congressional staffer run into the Longworth office building. And when he dried off an hour later, he looked even worse. And I just remember this very, you know, clear aha moment that was, why has no one made a dress shirt out of performance fabrics? I grew up playing golf and watched performance polos take over in the golf course. And just, I thought about the stretch, the, you know, moisture wicking, wrinkle resistant, all of those things, and wondered why no one had done it. And certainly there's plenty of performance fabrics you could never make a dress shirt out of, right? They've got holes in them like a basketball jersey, or they're too shiny, or, you know, whatever it might be. But I don't know, feels like there's a lot of different fabrics out there. And so I thought about the idea for many years, and I've been, it's been funny now building a second company, because with Mizzen and Main, I told almost no one about my idea for years because I was scared they were going to take it. And with Harbor, what I'm building now, I basically told anyone that will listen to me, anyone that will take a call, because I'm like, make my idea better, poke holes in it. You might know something that I don't. You might introduce me to somebody. And so I thought about it for years. And then ultimately, while I was working at Hunt, I just said, I've got to figure out, could this idea even work? And so I was tinkering, and I met some different people. And, you know, I don't think I've actually shared this. I was scared to for a long time. I haven't really shared it publicly, but for me, the unlock was a friend of my wife's family was the first employee at Heelys, the shoe with the wheel in the heel. So the inventor had this great idea, and a friend of the family of Jen, my wife, he was high up at Rollerblade, and an investment firm kind of plucked him out, and he built Heelys. And as we were talking over lunch one day, because I was just trying to figure out, how do I do this? He basically said, I don't consider going to a trade show. I didn't know what that was. But he said something about patents and technology. And that was an aha moment, where I then went and started doing a bunch of research on the patents in performance fabrics, which led me to the people who initially created the performance fibers, spandex, et cetera. But that was a rabbit hole that led me down to the people who make the fibers. Humorously, I started calling these people who make these fibers, and they're like, we don't sell fabric. We sell fibers to people who make fabric. And so I was like, all right, well, who do you sell it to? Like, give me your list, because I'm going to go call them. And that finally got me to the point that I had this initial performance fabric. I had a local seamstress make me my first shirt in 2011, because I didn't want to call anyone who made shirts in mass for fear that they would take my idea. Also, they wouldn't make me one shirt. But it was Christmas season of 2011. I remember coming home, and I had the first prototype on. And as I walked in the door, our dog had made a huge mess, and my wife was cleaning it up because I had come home from my job and picked up the prototype on the way home. And I stood there very proudly, kind of like, here it is, because she knew what I was working on. No one else did. And she basically said, you know, are you going to help us clean this up? Are you going to help us? Are you going to help me clean this up? And I said, well, what do you think? She said, what do I think about you helping me? And I said, I'm wearing the shirt. And it was this idea that we'd been talking about for years, that I had been dreaming about for years. And the fact that she didn't know I wasn't wearing, you know, a basketball jersey dress shirt, basically told me that this crazy idea could work. And so I started tinkering and, you know, trying to figure out how to, in my spare hours, make this thing a reality. And then in spring of 2012, aside from Jen and I actually got married that spring, I was asked to take a more prominent kind of outward facing role within the Hunt organization. And I was like, you know, this thing that I've been tinkering on the side, it's not taking up much time because there's not much I can do yet. I'm still trying to figure out what I'm doing, but I know I'm going to go do this. I have to tell them, because I can't accept this outward facing role and start interfacing with people on an external basis, knowing that I'm going to leave. And so I had to confront the hard reality that I wasn't ready. But I wanted to do the right thing by a great employer who had always done the right thing. And so I told them that I was going to leave to go start my own company, and they were very used to hearing, you know, that would go compete against them, that would try and be a service provider to them, or, you know, something like that, where understandably most people are shown the door that day, like, go ahead and close your laptop and we will escort you out the building. And then they were like, shirts? Okay. And I remember vividly, they're like, well, when do you need to leave? Because we had a very small team and I was basically the only investment analyst on the team. And I was like, probably not for another couple months, but I just couldn't not tell you at this point. And they're like, all right, well, I guess tell us when you can't do your job anymore. And they were so gracious, which gave me some extended runway to get the rest of my act together. And I've been so grateful to them ever since. And several of them have ended up investing in Mizzen and Main and now Harbor, which is a great testament to the relationship that we were able to build.
Yeah, I mean, that's remarkable when you can get that kind of support from an employer. It shows the type of people that run that organization, and really glad to hear that. And so you created this prototype out of this dream. And yeah, the fact that she didn't notice you were wearing this prototype is pretty cool. And, you know, give me the short version of how it went from this prototype shirt to a company actually selling shirts.
There were a couple main things to solve. One was naming the company and coming up with some sort of brand identity. I didn't understand or appreciate how much I would need to solve that over time, at the time, which is probably a good thing. And then finding someone to make 1,000 shirts. You know, it was an unsexy job of calling as many manufacturers as I could possibly find. Eventually someone said yes to work with me. On the branding side, the fun part there was my wife's, she worked at an ad agency. Her design partner, because she was the business side, her design partner's husband was also a creative. And the four of us were out to dinner. I told him about this kind of thing I was tinkering with. And he said, oh, well, you should name it Lavelle. Because that's what, you know, fashion people do. I'm like, that is not me. And the ego to name the company after myself when I'm not an apparel person just doesn't feel, it feels incongruent. And so I ended up coming up with a small equity agreement for he and a copywriter. And we went through all these iterations. I sort of wrote this free flowing prose of the type of brand I wanted to build. And the way that I sum it up is, if Nike and Ralph Lauren had a baby, it would be us. And we talked about, you know, I want it to look like a normal shirt, but I want it to have the performance characteristics. And he came up with 10 awesome names. Mizzen and Main was what we went with. That was such a fun process. Jen and I had come up with hundreds of names. Every time we would go out to dinner, you know, we're just sitting, you know, by the pool or whatever, we would just start writing names down, but Mizzen and Main really stuck.
People don't appreciate how difficult that process is. Naming businesses is miserable.
Yeah. And you can come up with 100 that you love, 50 that you say, I would definitely do this. And then 45 of them you can't for trademark reasons, the .com or .co isn't available, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's one of those things that, like, the brand name means nothing until you make it mean something, but you also got to get it right to give it the potential. And people can point to, you know, the Nike swoosh, and they're like, oh, they, you know, Phil Knight paid someone $10. And sure, that's a very rare example of the branding process being somewhat flippant and turning out exceptional. So we ended up making the first 1,000 shirts. And then in July of 2012, we published the website. Brooks Powell was, the first customer. I will never forget Brooks being the first customer of Mizzen and Main. And after 2 or 3 days of some friends and family buying some shirts, then our sales went to zero. And it was an moment when I realized, oh, this doesn't just happen. You have to now go sell these shirts. And I mean, the fast forward version there is, for the next year, I basically just did anything I could to sell one shirt at a time. I went to marathon expos. I went to, you know, bike races. I stood out on Katy Trail here in Dallas, handing out water bottles with our logo on it. I set up a rolling rack at Gold's Gym. And, you know, I was friends with some of the front desk people. They let me just kind of set something up. All of those things, you know, we did $50,000 in 2012, the 6 months into 2012. The next year we did $250,000. And then things just went, just hockey sticked up and to the right. And that's when, you know, I'll say the real fun started, because things were not like, I don't remember the last day where we had zero sales, but I do remember one day just going, oh, I haven't seen zero in a while. And that's when, I don't want to say it got easy because it, I mean, all sorts of new problems came along, but that's when I remember talking to some angel investors along the way and they're like, you don't have a business here. And I was like, I know, but here's what I'm going to build. And they're like, you don't have anything yet. And then, you know, I think it was probably a year later, we were really rolling. It was like, oh, wow, we actually have a business here. This is a real thing now.
Yeah, that's got to be a great feeling. And it's really cool to hear how you were hustling at the beginning. And, you know, that's, I can always relate to that amongst my new businesses. And they all require that, you know, to really get them off the ground. And you learn a lot doing that.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, ultimately you have to try a lot of things to figure out what will work. And then in 2015, we sponsored Tim Ferriss's podcast and we signed an endorsement deal with JJ Watt. And, it was that 2015 was the first year where, I mean, we were just, it felt like we couldn't miss. We introduced the Leeward line at that point in time. And I think the first Leeward run of shirts was, there were four styles and we made 1,000 of each. And we sold out of all four, you know, across, you sort of hit sellout point when you no longer have like mediums and larges, and there may have still been some individual units left. It was like 7 days. We sold out of 4,000 shirts. And that unfortunately gave us the confidence that we couldn't miss. And there were lots of misses that came after that. But the fun story there is, you know, we were, I don't know, Jeff, if you've ever had one of our Spinnaker shirts, we don't sell many of them anymore, maybe if at all. But we could only do two colors with Spinnakers, white and a color. And I mean, we did basically every iteration you could imagine in 2014. And we had this moment where we sort of said, we're going to run out of color combinations and people are just going to stop buying this check pattern of one color and white. And so I was on this life or death mission to find the next fabric where we could do patterns. And I spent, I don't know how many hours in trade show fabric showrooms, everything, just doing anything I could to find a fabric. And I mean, I would go into these showrooms and there would be 3,000 fabric swatches on the wall. And I would basically just go, no, 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 no. And just feel these fabrics to say, could this be a dress shirt? And, you know, I would love one and then realize it's basically the same thing as our current problem, which is I can't do multiple colors. And this one showroom in New York, I found this, it was a gingham pattern with eight different, maybe a Madras pattern with eight, it was Madras with eight different colors on it. And it was a whole goldmine moment because now I can do other colors. And to the outside world, they just sort of like, oh, this is a cool new pattern. And for us, it was like, we would not still exist had we not found that fabric. I don't know when we would have found another one, but that was a, I think that was in late, I think it was in maybe in mid 2015. And then we debuted it, I want to say in maybe late 2014, we debuted it in mid 2015. And it changed everything for the business.
Yeah. Wow. And I mean, you guys definitely have a lot of variety now. There's some tremendous options. I'm glad that you found that. And, you know, you built this awesome business. It was growing. And then, you know, we met during this time at Stand Together in 2018. And then, you know, in 2019, we were served the surprise that you were going to step down as CEO. And I'm curious, you know, what led to that?
So in 2017, we signed a growth equity investment deal with L. Catterton, the world's largest consumer retail private equity firm. Catterton Partners is a 30-year-old storied PE firm based out of Greenwich. And they merged their entities, and I'm probably saying it wrong, but with L Capital, which is the investment group from the LVMH group, and then Bernard Arnault's family office. They did this big merger for L. Catterton. In 2016, my son was born December 1st. I signed the term sheet with Elkaderton in that delivery room, which was quite a memory. We closed the deal a couple months later, and we were just on this rocket ship. Again, it felt like we couldn't miss. There was a new crisis every day, but it also felt like we couldn't miss. We're going and going and going. I'd seen enough other entrepreneurs and talked to enough people that I said, I want to bring in an executive coach that can help me identify what I'm missing for myself and the team. And just this awesome coach, her name's Julie. She came in and we did this robust assessment of myself and got 360 feedback from the board and the leadership team. And the summary of that was a few things. One, she said, I need you to internalize that this thing is likely going to fail and you fundamentally don't believe it will. You need to get right with the fact that statistically it will. And it's not some cliche that you're just like, oh yeah, no, most businesses fail. Like, you really need to understand that. And basically, like, you are really lucky that it hasn't yet. And the second piece of that was kind of understanding the team that I needed around me, in some cases that I had and in some cases that I didn't. And then also, what am I great at and what am I barely hanging on to, and what do I need to not be doing at all now that we're at a certain size? And anyone who's built a business from the ground up will resonate with, there's this phase where the mistakes that you make, you can just sort of like, well, we survived. And then you get to a certain size where the mistake that you make is a $5 million purchase order and you can't survive it. Or if you can, you're no longer the same thing, right? I will gloss over some of the specifics to be respectful of some people involved, but like, we needed one or two roles in, some of them didn't end up working out. And I got to this point where overall things were going well, but I got to this point where I said, you know, I think we need a president, someone who knows apparel, has been around this space before. And the way that I described it is like, whether we make 15,000 of these or 20,000 of these, and whether we introduce them in September or November, like, I don't care. I just want to go sell the next $10 million worth of product, and I'm good at that. But I don't necessarily want to be on the phone yelling at our manufacturers, our 3PL, like all that stuff. Some people are born for that. And that is something that I have barely survived. I've done enough right to get us to this point. So I'm sharing some of these specifics because I really hope that they are helpful to someone listening, and to do that real self-assessment. And it was around that time that I said, I'm ready to hire a president, that I got an email from Brian Hooks, the CEO of Stand Together. And he said, Chase and I are going to be, I think he said something like, Chase and I want to have dinner. Chase Koch's founder of Stand Together Ventures, president and founder of Koch Disruptive Industries. He said, we'd love to have dinner sometime soon. And I basically said, like, sure. You know, I'd been around the Stand Together ecosystem for a couple years. I believed vehemently in the work that Stand Together does. And also, I'd spent several years going all, you know, to Wichita and taking market-based management courses, now principle-based management courses, to learn how to apply this philosophy better in my business. And so it wasn't a surprise to get an email, but it was a surprise, you know, to say, like, let's grab dinner. So I remember saying, well, sure, where do you want to have dinner? Chase is in Wichita and you're in DC and I live in Dallas. And he said, oh, we'll come to Dallas. And so they had some other stuff going on, schedules aligned. And at dinner, they asked if I would come on board to help drive some real innovation and change within the group that you and I were a part of. At the time, it was called New Leaders, and then also build some new capabilities. And the easiest way to sum up what was asked at the time was, how do we help nonprofit and for-profit entrepreneurs aligned with our vision accelerate their capabilities with technology and this group and the broader Stand Together community? That was a heavy dinner in terms of, okay, this is not where I thought my life was going. And certainly I knew there was a lot to unpack, but I also felt this pull of, I don't think I can turn this ask down, because I had moved to this place of being ready for someone who knew how to build an apparel company to come in and take a meaningful role in the business, right? They run this. Let me go. We had just signed an endorsement deal with I can't remember if we just signed an endorsement deal with Phil or if it had been around for a while, but we were at all doors with Nordstrom. Like, my job was to go sell, 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 and build the company culture and establish the capabilities of the business with the right team around me. And so there were also some mistakes in my viewing of the team at that point in time. But ultimately, I got to this point where I just said, you know, I don't know, so many people who are founders are not the right people to take their business to the next level. And I'm not ready to leave Mizzen and Main, but maybe this is a sign that, like, I can leave on a real high note, hand the reins to somebody who can take us to the next level, and I can be the founder of that successful thing rather than the guy who wouldn't let go. That was a big part of what I was processing. And then ultimately, because of the work I'd done with the executive coach, I just remember thinking again and again, like, what are my weaknesses and what am I best at? And anyway, I've been giving a lot of details here and I feel like I've been talking too long, but long story short, decided to bring in a new CEO and I would remain on as chairman of the board and stay helpful wherever they needed me. And I would embrace this chance to go really make a very positive impact on the world. Lots of excitement, lots of challenges. My wife and I had just moved into a house that we'd spent 6 months renovating to the studs. And we were in our dream house, our dream spot. Everything seemed like it was perfect. And through a big monkey wrench in our life, our daughter, I remember talking to Brian in the delivery room with my daughter about taking this role. So we got the two delivery rooms with big consequential contracts. But ultimately felt like it was the right call for everybody. And yeah, that was a longer answer than I intended, but hopefully enough details to provide some real meat there.
If you're enjoying this episode, I would greatly appreciate if you could review, like, comment, or subscribe on your favorite platforms. Your engaged support goes a long way in helping the show grow and getting our impactful guests heard. Now back to the show. Yeah, definitely. And, you know, if folks want to go back and learn more about Brian Hooks, they can check out episode 43 with him. You know, huge fan of his and Stand Together overall and all that they're doing. And yeah, I mean, it sounds like it's sort of this opportunity was unexpectedly thrust upon you at this moment of transition and felt like the right move to make. And, you know, as a member of the group, you know, Stand Together Ventures, I certainly felt the change. It was really cool to be a part of the growth of this area of Stand Together and to maximize the capabilities of this great sort of partnership network that we've built. And I know that I recall my feeling at the time was I was surprised to hear you leave Mizzen and Main, at least leave your role. But I was excited for you to join Stand Together.
Yeah, thanks. And I mean, so many awesome Stand Together Ventures at the time, new leaders, you know, partners were so excited and enthusiastic and were really great partners in the transition process. I felt very grateful for the friendships there too.
Yeah. Yeah. It was, you did a really good job of sort of transitioning from being just a member to going to this new role, but also still kind of being a member in a good way.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks, man.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's Stand Together just touches so many important areas of society. So I'm sure that was an enticing aspect of it. You know, you want to live this life of meaning. And, you know, you spent, I believe, what was it, 3 years there?
Yeah. So spent 3 years with Stand Together. We moved up to DC, well, Northern Virginia. And that was summer of 2019. Fast and furious, lots of changes. We built Stand Together. We transitioned new leaders into Stand Together Ventures, launched Stand Together Ventures Lab, hired Shin.
Podcast guest.
Yes, I love, Shin's such a great guy and has built something really special there from that original idea. There were so many incredible things that I got to do as a part of that team. And then, boom, COVID hit. And we had moved to the area, left Dallas in March of, I think March, I want to say like March 8th. I remember basically saying like, I'm not coming to the office anymore. I remember feeling crazy saying, I don't think I'm going to come in. And then of course, a few days later, everything shut down. But then we were sort of on an island because with two very young kids moving to an area like Northern Virginia and not really a neighborhood, we just didn't really meet that many people right away. And then the world shut down. And especially in the mid-Atlantic and Northeast, I mean, they had like chains on playgrounds all summer long. And, you weren't allowed to go on a running trail. In Dallas, people sat on their front driveways and there were these neighborhood events where everyone's out in the street. And we were very, very isolated there. And when fall of 2020 came around, we're still doing great work as a team, Staying Together Ventures. We kept going. But fall of 2020 came around and it didn't look like that schools, especially in the Northeast, Mid-Atlantic, were going to open even in the fall of 2021. Like that much later, they were still not going to open based on all the lists of demands from a lot of different groups. And so I just remember thinking, like, why are we living here? Like, I'm working remotely in a city where we know no one, we have no family, and I've got two young kids, and this is a rather hostile environment to wanting to like meet anybody, given so many aspects of that area during COVID. And so we decided to move back to Dallas. Brian was very gracious. He didn't want me to go, and my commitment was I'm not leaving Staying Together. I just need to be somewhere with family and friends and just a better environment for us. So I moved back to Dallas, and around that time, he also had asked me to take on a new role, which was helping evolve the capabilities of our fundraising team. And there were some really, big opportunities in that world. And so my role shifted with Stand Together in a pretty meaningful way, and I ended up leading that group for about another 14 or 15 months or so. And fast forwarding, I've been kind of rambling on in some of this, but hopefully again helpful. The long story short of it was, as I reflected on 2023 in, excuse me, 2021 into 2022, and thought about where I was in my life and with some of the challenges that Mizzen and Main went through during COVID and life back here in Dallas, I just had this pull to say, I didn't finish the job with Mizzen and Main. It's still going, and post 2020, it was a rough year in 2020, but the business was doing really well again. I think I want to do one more run at building a company.
Oh,
Like
it's
I
one
just
more.
wasn't, I yeah, maybe I don't know about two more, but I wanted to do one more run at building a company from the ground up. And one of the things that I so appreciated about Staying Together, Koch Industries, MBM now called PBM, is this respect and adherence to what are your comparative advantages. And I just, in some reflection at the end of the year and some health issues that had happened in our family, just sort of said, I think I'm supposed to do one more run. And this idea for what is now Harbor had been percolating for years since my son was born, and I'd signed that term sheet in the delivery room. So spent some time reflecting, talked with Brian, and ultimately said, I'm not running away. I'm here for a while. I'm here to transition, but I need to do this one more time. And also will be committing some of what I build to the Stand Together community. And so he was disappointed, but again, understanding in and they practice what they preach and wanting to support people's North Star. And so in early 22, I stepped down and basically spent a few months exploring, trying to figure out if I could start Harbor. And then by the middle of the year, I found a great co-founder and we were off to the races.
Awesome. Well, I'm sorry we've gone this long without digging too deeply into Harbor.
All
Really
good.
excited for your new business. Certainly one that I can relate to the need for. We can dig into that a little bit, but talk about when the concept started percolating when you first had kids to, how it made it to a point where you were like, I'm going to dig in and do this.
Yeah, so when my son was born, I did a whole bunch of research, and any parent knows that when you tell other people that you're going to have a kid, you get a list of recommendations. Here's the car seat. Here's the stroller. Here's the this, 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 this. Really, no one says that about baby monitors because they're pretty antiquated, frankly, junky devices. And so the one that was basically top of the research list was a company called Nanit. They're still around today. And it is a Wi-Fi camera that runs an app on your phone. And I thought, oh, cool, an app on my phone. That's great. I don't want something else. And I woke up one morning, my son was a couple months old. He was in his own room, and the app on your phone is supposed to run background audio all night long. And I woke up one morning and there was no audio running. And moment of panic, you check it, try and figure out what's going on, ran upstairs. He was fine. Kids are far more resilient than we give them credit for, but it's understandable concern. But I did a little bit of research and learned you can't rely on a Wi-Fi based app on your phone to be a baby monitor. It's a security camera that you can look in on whenever you want, assuming it's still connected, but it's not a baby monitor. And this is true for any of those devices. And as I did a little bit of research, a bunch of parents use Nest or Google or Ring or any of those like Wise Wi-Fi cameras kind of as a baby monitor, because it's basically the same thing, except for it's not. You can't rely on that. So we went out and bought an old school Motorola camera and an old school Motorola monitor, not that high quality of a device, but kind of built like a tank. And, sure. So we ran two systems in parallel. We had the old school device so that we had a dedicated monitor, and we had the Wi-Fi so that when we're out of the house and want to check in on a babysitter, we can do that. 7 years later, no one has built a better device. And that's ultimately why we decided to build Harbor.
And I recall my own wife and I looking into baby monitors and definitely hearing the same thing. Oh, well, they all suck. People would come to me after like, oh, we have this one, but most of them suck. I spent the time researching to find one that had both a dedicated physical monitor as well as Wi-Fi. And it wasn't easy to find, and it was cumbersome to use and cumbersome to do both things, but we got it. But again, relatively unreliable. So I can certainly relate to the problems. It's some of the best entrepreneurial ideas, are launched from these personal issues that you're dealing with. And so how did you decide that you were going to solve this?
So, ultimately I thought about Mizzen and Main for, I think, 7 years before I started Mizzen and Main with Harbor. I'd thought about it since my son was born because of my own personal, frustrations and experience with the product. So 2022 was, I'm not a technical person. I have to figure out how to go do this. And so I started sort of collecting advisors, some of whom I paid, some of whom, there's some sort of relationship with, and eventually met Charlie Hill, my co-founder, through a friend. And he is a chief development, chief product officer. That's his background. And importantly for me, he was a chief development product officer at an IoT startup that was acquired by a very large company. So he's got a ton of experience in the space. He's also a dad of two. So we're building the product that we, want to have for our own kids. We officially launched in, I think it was August, September of 22. We raised a pre-seed round from Trust Ventures, which allowed us to get going and bring some contractors on board and start paying for, all the stuff that goes into making electronics, which is incredibly difficult. Yep. Not least of which is because we're making a camera and a tablet, and the camera and the tablet connecting to each other directly without internet in a reliable way is actually a very difficult problem to solve. And no one's really done it. It's very janky, and they're basically workarounds that people have used so far to sort of hack together that experience. And we basically said, like, I want the iPhone or the Peloton experience of a baby monitor. And just no one has made that before. So the kind of key milestones for us were finding the chips, the silicon that actually power the devices, and having those companies agree to work with us, finding ODMs to actually build the product, and then starting the process of building out everything else, the actual software, the firmware, and all of that. And in the interim, one of the things that came to light through this process was the opportunity to build a remote night nanny platform. And the idea here is, instead of someone coming into your house for $400 to $700 or more a night, if you can even find somebody, which you can't in most cities, what we wanted to do was democratize that access to sleep expertise. Because we have built the product ourselves, we built in a whole bunch of reliability and security so that if you were to say, I'd like your help, what we do is you grant us access to your camera and tablet, our monitor. We then turn the volume all the way down all night long and turn it back up whenever you should go in and take action with your child. So if something is wrong, or if a threshold is reached by which a professional night nurse would say, it's time for me to go in if they were in your house. Well, they're not in your house. They're remote. And so we've got a bunch of fail-safe backups. And the idea fundamentally is you should be able to sleep unless your child really needs you. And if they cough or they cry for 30 seconds and stop, you don't need to go tend to your child. But as a parent, it can be 30 to 45 minutes before you go back to sleep. And so you can go a whole night without actually going into your child's room and not sleep at all. And so like that's something that you don't really internalize until you start to raise your own kids. Even if you are doing a great job and you're following all the right steps, you could be awake all night long. And so what we're doing is saying, we will have a professional who is trained in this, and we've already done a dozen of these, that will make it so that you are aware if you need to go in, but otherwise you won't hear anything. And so we've done a dozen of these trials, which I'm sure we'll talk about. And the results have been amazing. People have told us that we changed their lives. And we are excited to be able to bring this expertise to such a wider segment of the population that could never afford something as incredible as a night nanny.
Yeah. I mean, wow, I love that. And when I tell people about it, that's what I say is you're democratizing, you know, the sleep expertise. I really appreciate that. And, you know, our family was fortunate to be part of one of the beta tests. And, you know, for that part, you know, you were using one of those Wi-Fi type cameras that we were giving you guys access to. And then you had a remote night nanny that was watching, you know, our son sleep. And, you know, the first part of like, getting over not having our own monitor on all the time, that was tougher for Jess. You know, I wanted sleep. But it's such a huge thing to acknowledge that like, you don't need to hear every cough. We immediately got significantly better sleep. I remember our night nurse, her name was Brittany, and you know, we just had it set on our phone so she could get through the do not disturb if she needed us. And like, you know, it was relatively infrequent, and we'd had a tough time prior to that with, you know, when Rowan was pretty young, and it was amazing to wake up to, you know, having a good night's sleep.
Yeah. And, you know, I think importantly, I didn't want to betray too much of this if you weren't ready to talk about having gone through the process.
Yeah.
You all had already been through it once, and this is your second child. And I remember Jess telling us at the end of the trial, the beta test, you know, you gave me hope to have a third child, to which you were like, okay, hold on a second, wait a second. But it doesn't matter how good you think you are at it. When you are going for weeks or months on end without healthy sleep, there is a sense of desperation that can come along. And what we found in doing our research is there are plenty of parents who could afford 24/7 help, and they could get all the sleep that they want, but they don't necessarily feel comfortable with someone in their house, or they don't want someone else taking care of their child. To each their own. I pass no judgment, and everyone needs to find the best way to raise their kids. But our point is we can bring a level of expertise to bear with technology that has never been possible before. And one thing I just want to say, if anyone's listening to this, be like, oh, that's weird. Someone else can look in on your camera. The way that we frame this up is we can never see anything on your camera because it is encrypted unless you grant us access to your camera. So a little bit like Zoom, if you don't give me screen share access, I can't see your screen when we're on Zoom together. So this is only possible if you grant us access. You've been through an onboarding protocol and process, and there's a lot of work that happens before we would just be able to work with you in that regard. But we've done, again, about a dozen of these trials, and they've been life-changing, and we are so excited to be able to expand the number of people that we're working with here.
Yeah, I mean, I'm excited for the future parents that are going to get to utilize this, you know, especially if they've been through it on their own before, because it makes just such an incredible difference. And, you know, I when you were first getting started, you know, I wasn't sure exactly where you were going, but now to see that you have, you know, you've built this beautiful technology and hardware to go along with this great concept, and that seems like there's sort of different levels. Like if someone just wanted to use the hardware, they can, but then if they want to go up and do, you know, some of this service stuff, like it just seems like a really cool setup.
Yeah, thanks. The way that we've approached this is there are going to be some people that are going to say, I've got it, or I don't want help. And so if you don't want to work with us from a remote night nanny perspective, you don't have to, you won't be billed for it, you're not paying for it and not getting the benefit. We have our camera and our monitor and all of our software and features. That's one package. And then parents can choose to work with us from a remote night nanny perspective as often as or as little as they would like.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I hope that people that are struggling, you know, do end up trying it out and seeing how much it can change things. And it's that, like you said, it's that happy medium between listening to every cough and having someone in your house.
Yep. 100%. And ultimately we've taken some of that inspiration to when your child is 18 weeks old, you need to hear everything. I get it. But when they're 18 months old, you actually need to hear almost nothing. And so past the sleep training phase, when you would no longer work with us from a remote night nanny perspective, we've built smart audio, which intelligently filters out noises at the comfort level that parents are good with. And so some parents are going to want to hear everything. That's fine. But I just remember, you know, my daughter, 18 months old, she'd have a cough one night. It'd be like cough, cough every 5 to 20 minutes. And that means I'm awake all night long. I don't need to hear cough. I need to hear if she fell out of bed, if something is wrong, if she's screaming. I need to hear that at an age-appropriate level. And so we've made it so that parents can have those features at an age-appropriate level at whatever threshold they're comfortable with.
So parents that are listening that, you know, want to use Harbor products, you know, what steps do they take? What ages should their kids be?
Yeah. So harbor.co is our website. We have a wait list live. We launched it in late February of 24. Our first 100 units sold out basically immediately. Those will be shipping this spring. And then this late summer, we'll begin shipping the kind of mass production. So we're continuing to take waitlist deposits. It's a $25 refundable deposit. And then we'll have our official pre-sale where you can actually like put the money down to get your actual product shipping later this summer. That'll be late spring as well. And then once you have the product, then you can sign up for the remote night nanny service. But you have to have our product because we can't replicate this functionality without it.
Got it. Yeah, that makes total sense. And what's the price point on the hardware?
It's so we're doing, if you're familiar with Whoop, it's inspired by the Whoop model. We're doing a $28 a month membership, but it requires a 2-year membership. That puts us at basically price competitive to the existing Wi-Fi solutions that are out there, but you actually get a 10-inch tablet and all these other features and benefits. And ultimately, if you want to keep the product after that, you can continue the subscription. And if you want to donate it, you can donate it. Or if you want to send it back, we'll recycle it appropriately. But that gives parents the functionality and flexibility that they would need. And then also, you know, if you have a baby monitor, you're using it for most parents, it's 3 to 4 years, but we figure give people an out if they're interested in not continuing to use it. They don't have to sign up for the 3 to 4 years.
Got it. Yeah. And I'm sure people will appreciate that flexibility. And one thing that came to mind for me is with the sort of direct connect is we always struggle when we're traveling. You know, we have kind of a mediocre, you know, device we've bought for travel. And it's like, this one seems like, you know, I might want a second one just to bring on trips because it's going to, you don't have to worry about the whole Wi-Fi aspect.
Yep. This solves the travel aspect in a huge way. And we've had a lot of very thoughtful features built in, like to mount it to the wall, we've made it really simple and you can just unscrew it and pop it off the wall. So you don't have to like mount and dismount in some crazy function. Like once it's up there, it's up there. And if you want to take it with you to travel, you can just unscrew it, pop it right off the wall. Super easy. No tools required to bring it with you to travel.
Yeah, that's nice. That's why we have like the crappiest ones that we'd bring on travel because it's such a pain in the ass to take it off the wall.
Yeah, for sure.
And, you know, the thing I really love about this is like when you look at the underlying impact, I mean, providing parents with a good night's sleep changes lives for the better. Like there's no question.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, our mission is happier parents and healthier families, one restful night at a time, but it is really hard to be a calm, present, patient parent when you haven't slept for days or weeks on end. And then you think about the relationship with your spouse. You think about driving drowsy is incredibly dangerous. You think about the long-term mental and physical health impacts of poor sleep. They're so well documented, I don't even need to bring it up. And then how you show up in your community, how you show up at work, all of these things. If we can help parents sleep, it will change lives, as you said. But also, if you can help a child establish healthy sleep habits and rhythms at a very young age, it changes that child's life as well. Because a good, healthy sleeper is better at dysregulation. They're better at being able to pay attention. They're better at managing food. They're better at all of these things that start to come up that are really tough for young kids. I appreciate you saying it. We believe that the impact can be very significant. I'll say humorously, I sometimes undersell what we're trying to work on because I don't want to sound like that show Silicon Valley where it's like changing the world one API at a time. But ultimately, we do feel like this can change people's lives. And it's been such an awesome ride so far. Charlie has been a great co-founder. We have a great team. Trust Ventures backed us when no one else would, you know, take a swing and a bet. 22, 23 was just this depths of hell of VC fundraising. And, you know, I chuckle so many pre-seed companies have a website that say, you know, we want to partner with an entrepreneur and an idea. And, you know, we love backing repeat founders with proven track records. I'm like, ding, ding, ding. Like, yeah. Let's partner. And they're like, ooh, call us when you have $1 million in ARR. Like, who are you backing that is an entrepreneur and an idea and $1 million in ARR? But there are some great firms out there that we are very fortunate to work with Trust. And there are some great firms that don't present themselves as pre-seed, you know, exclusives, that they invest up and down the stages, that we've been very grateful to stay in touch with. And I just chuckle at these pre-seed firms that it was a friend of mine that said, Kevin, you need to remember that website and that promise is for their LPs. They use that website to raise capital from their LPs. They do not mean it with founders. And I had to learn that lesson and stop getting so frustrated.
Yeah, no, unfortunately that is the case with too many organizations that, you know, say one thing but practice another. Certainly a frustration I've found in a variety of areas of business, but when you find the right partners, it goes such a long way. And so you got over that initial fundraising hump, and, you know, where are things now and what are your hopes and vision for the future?
So we officially launched our wait list for people to sign up and reserve a spot in line, $25 refundable deposit. That was in February of 24. We are in the final stages of the kind of hardware refinement, which is you make a couple hundred, then you make a couple thousand, and there's all these checks along the way to ensure equality. And when you rush that, that's when you run into problems. So we're making sure to take our time. So we are in the process where we'll ship our first 100 units to customers this spring, and then our full production line will be stood up and spinning off products late summer. We've got a team of 9 so far. We've got kind of a hodgepodge of that's full time. We've got some people that do an hour or two a month of consulting with us, and some people that are full time contractors and everything in between. So all told, we're probably working with 30 people right now, which is an incredible thing to get to do. And then we've got our camera and our tablet manufacturing. Both lines are being set up outside of China. And we think that's something that some parents are directly telling us they care about, and others, you know, as you come and present options, I think it will be an increasing request and requirement from parents. So we've got some great manufacturing partners that we're excited about. And then now it's just about spreading the word. You know, I reached out to you about, okay, I'm finally ready to talk, because for a long time we were just under the radar. We didn't want to tell anyone what we were working on publicly. I would talk to anybody about it, but we weren't broadcasting what we were doing. We didn't have a website up because we wanted to be ready to present appropriately to the public. And so now, you know, I'm telling everyone that'll hear about it. And the response has been fantastic. We've got hundreds of people on the wait list after a short period of time. And you think about a wait list for a baby monitor, that's kind of a small total audience. So we feel like it's a good initial validation, and then we'll move to pre-sales, and then we'll begin shipping product.
Love it. Well, really excited for that. And that reminded me to circle back briefly to something you said earlier, which is when you were thinking about Mizzen and Main, you were kind of scared to tell people. And with my first entrepreneurial endeavors, it was similar. Like, I was like, I can't tell everybody about this. They're going to steal it, et cetera. And the reality is that, you know, ideas are a dime a dozen. It's all about execution. And most people don't want to or have the ability to execute on your vision.
No. Definitely not. And the other thing is, especially as someone who feels like, man, I just came up with this really good idea. A lot of other people have had that idea. There are very, very few original ideas. It's all about execution and delivering real value to the customer. And this is part of what I'm so excited about with Harbor is a lot of people are very scared to create a physical product company for a whole host of reasons. But I look at what we will create, creating value for parents, of course, but also our product will be a part of their life for years in a very meaningful way. We will be there in their homes with them. That is a way that we can build a relationship with a customer that can last far beyond the physical product in their lives. And our vision is to create this entire stack of services that can create real value for parents. Every parent that I know has had the, it's 2 a.m., something is wrong, I don't know what to do. I'm not calling 911, but I'm definitely wanting to talk to somebody. And that is a lonely and scary time for parents. And we aim to solve that gap for parents. Now, certainly other companies can do pediatric telehealth, but we think with our relationship with customers, we're going to be able to offer more services because we're already a part of their lives. And I don't mean this as to try and sell everything that we possibly can. I'm saying we're already there. They'll have an app that is a part of our ecosystem. Just press a button and be talking to a doctor. How great would that be? That's a big part of our long-term vision as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that as a parent, you can imagine some of the heart attacks that people are starting to have in the middle of the night. And, you know, we're fortunate that my wife has an aunt abroad who's a pediatrician. So she's on a different time zone, works out well for us, but most people don't have that.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, sometimes you just need to call 911, but most of the time, if you take your child to the emergency room or urgent care, you're going to be sitting in the lobby of the emergency room or the urgent care for hours. And so anything you can do to care for your child at home, as long as you're confident in it and it's good sound medical advice, we want to be able to bring that. And again, democratize that access to expertise. And if we can keep kids out of emergency rooms that shouldn't be there, that's better for everybody.
Absolutely. And I'm excited to have a front row seat as you grow this business and excited to see where it goes. And, you know, I'll say that, you know, I love that you are making sleep a better possibility for so many parents. And then if I go back to Mizzen and Main, I'll say that, you know, you're bringing a lot of positive impact there in terms of comfort and joy around the clothing. I mean, for me specifically, like when I find something comfortable, it's just, it changes my life. You know, like I can be happy wearing these way more than I wanted to wear button down shirts before, for instance. Yeah. And, you know, and I had tried so many different types or so many people targeting that audience that's looking for good looking comfort. And so, you know, you not only sold the concept, but you really deliver. I genuinely appreciate that. And
thanks, man.
And in your work, you know, you've positively affected many people. And I'm curious, have there been any specific moments in your career where you really saw, you know, how much your work could affect, change, or affect individual lives?
I'm sure I could talk about all sorts of, I could probably talk about this topic alone for 3 hours and maybe we'd come back to that another time. I'll pick two. One thing that comes to mind for me is the ability to connect people to opportunities. You know, there are some folks that I invited to a Stand Together event that ended up meeting people that they started businesses with. There are times where I've gotten a call for someone, you know, they're one of three or four people being considered for a role. And, you know, I'll get on the phone with the person doing the hiring and I will say, like, I'll bet my reputation on this person. And those, without divulging anything, you know, specific that someone may not want to share, those moments I think are, because of the work that I've done and the brands that I've built, and the reputation that I've built, if I can help advance someone else's career or put them in an opportunity for them to go see something, I just, that means so much to me, because I've been so fortunate to have some folks do the same for me. And then very tactically, getting to hire people from, you know, not Harvard, people from backgrounds without a college degree or a college that most people wouldn't recognize, and put them in an opportunity to create value and grow their career is more satisfying than almost anything from a professional perspective that I've ever experienced. It matters. Like, a lot of people can't go to college, and we could probably spend an entire podcast talking about how billions of dollars are wasted on higher ed by people who shouldn't be going to higher ed, because they're basically, it's a 4-year vacation and they graduate without any real skills. That's very different for some degrees and some colleges and some people, but like writ large, higher ed has failed American society. Yeah. And cost an incalculable amount to society. And so when I think about the jobs that employers have and we get to have, is to give people an opportunity to go create that value. Those are some of the most memorable experiences I have. Certainly no shortage of challenges in managing personnel. It's the best and worst part of being an entrepreneur. But to me, the best outweighs the worst many times over in terms of that feeling of gratitude and creating opportunities.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree 1,000%. And it's really cool to hear, you know, how your journey has gone and how, you know, it's impacted so many. And you have an amazing family. And aside from family, if all were to end tomorrow, whatever that means to you, you know, what are you most grateful for or most proud of?
I think I would sum it up in the time that I have been able to spend with my family and some really great people. So Ryan Kent is now the CEO of Mizzen & Main and one of the greatest people I've ever had the privilege of knowing. Just every part of him is like the best of any of us. I get a little emotional thinking about what an incredible human he is and how gracious he was with me over so many years, being both a friend and a colleague. You know, being an entrepreneur means, kind of, as you said, burning it on both ends. I think I'm doing a little better job this time than I did the first time. But it also has meant I'm able to show up at my son's soccer games at 4:30 on a Tuesday. It was a mentor of mine who told me that, like, you're going to feel the weight of it more than most people in business because of the weight of your role, but also you get to say what the priorities are. And so you get to say, I'm going to be at my son's soccer games. Now, there are some times where it's like, hey, I'm doing a TV interview in 2 weeks and I have to fly out on my anniversary so that I can be there for the next morning. Now, my wife is very supportive and understanding. We're going to celebrate the night before, but also like more times than not, I get to drive that prioritization. And I am very grateful that it has enabled me to build such meaningful relationships with my kids. And I look at some friends who, you know, they have a stable job, but they also stably work 80 hours a week in an office outside of their house. And I'm okay with that trade-off for my family, that I get to be here. And certainly the stress is very different. But I'm very grateful that I get to build a life where I'm around my kids.
Yeah. Yeah. That's beautiful. And, you know, something I strive for as well, to try to find that unique balance that each person has. And, you know, that thought led me to want to circle back briefly to Mizzen & Main and just ask, you know, now you're chairman of the board, what is sort of your current relationship with the business?
Whatever the business needs from me. And so in some cases that's interviewing somebody we're trying to bring into the business to help kind of give them some context of the backstory and the nature of the cap table and where we're trying to go. I will come in and we'll do like creative briefs where we're talking about a campaign and they're just appreciative to hear my perspective, but not obligated to act on my direction. And I think that's the right balance. Not that I have all the answers and this business should be whatever Kevin thinks should happen, but I had a vision for what we wanted to create. And I've been a part of all of these iterations over time. And so I try and share perspective that can help them make a decision. Ultimately, I think for nearly all of it, they know exactly what they're trying to do. It's just about seeking additional input and guidance. Certainly, you know, board meetings, and then Ryan, who has been running the organization since 2021, just being a thought partner to him. CEO is a super lonely job. And since I had that seat before, I just try and be as good of a sounding board as I can to him.
Yeah, it's great that you're able to provide that support for him. I'm sure that goes a really long way. And, you know, lastly, I want to ask the question that I make sure to ask every guest. If you could snap your fingers and fix one thing in the world, what would it be? And how do you think that change would reverberate?
Oh, man. I knew this question was coming and I still am overwhelmed by it. If I could snap my fingers, you know, I'm going to put it in the in somewhat of the context of reality, like world peace, no hunger. Those would be the things that obviously I would wish most. But if I could say something along the lines of reality, it would be to inspire people to, you know, take care of their home life and their family first. And if you get that in order, and it's something Jordan Peterson talks about, you know, make your bed. Like if you take care of things at home without trying to solve world peace and world hunger, so many things around you will be better. If moms and dads or whatever the home life situation is, took care of each other and their kids, the world would be a better place. And that doesn't require us solving world peace or world hunger. It just is, you know, treat people with dignity and respect in your own life and in your own circle. And then that will reverberate everywhere else. Kids need parents. Kids, there's a lot we could talk about, all the things that are wrong as to how kids are raised. We'll save that for another conversation, but kids need parents that love them, hold them, you know, to high standards, give them options for or opportunities for responsibility. And kids need parents that love each other. And if we could do that, yeah, I would say that would solve a lot. And I could come up with 100 more answers to that question, but that's what I'm going to go with.
Yeah, no, I truly believe that would reverberate. Families taking care of each other, caring about each other. I know, you know, Ryan Holiday says a lot, the best thing a dad can do is to love their kid's mom. And whether, you know, whether you're together or not, loving the mother of your children is so important. So I think that the way you've explained that expands on that, and what a better world we'd be if people were able to do that.
Amen. Appreciate it, man. How about you? What's your answer to that question? You've heard lots of answers to it. What's your present answer to that question?
Oh man. Yeah. I'd say it certainly changes with all of these, but in terms of snapping my fingers, you know, I generally would say giving people the resources that they need to survive so that the individuals on earth don't have to worry about everyday survival and can instead focus on what they're passionate about and find their true potential.
It's great, man. It's great.
So it's been awesome talking to you, you know, would love to have you on again in the future, see how Harbor's going. But in the meantime, those listening, how can they best support you, your work, your impact?
Right now, the most important thing would be tell anyone who's a parent that has a baby monitor or needs a baby monitor to go to harbor.co and sign up for our wait list. And depending on when this airs, you know, buy one of the devices so that we can help transform families and help parents get sleep and help kids get healthy sleep habits. And then the second would be, we're going to continue from the question a minute ago, would be, you know, love the mother of your children, and love your spouse and love your kids.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, I love that. It's a great way to end it. Kevin, thanks so much for your time. Thanks for sharing your story with us, and I'm excited to share it with the world.
Thanks, Jeff. Appreciate the opportunity.
Thanks for listening to this episode of People Are the Answer. If you enjoyed the episode, share it with friends, and reviews or subscriptions on your favorite platforms go a long way to help the show grow. I want to share these incredible people and their remarkable work with as many others as possible. Thanks for your support. For more, go to peoplearetheanswer.com.